Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, I include my full conversation with Podcastica's Jason Kabasi. If you are a Cocoons of Horror listener, you probably already heard this interview. Although, I've looked at the numbers, and several thousand people have not yet heard this interview. So that'll be at the end of this podcast. Before I get to Jason, Steve and I talk about Stormborn. This is the second episode of Season 7. Sam cures Jorah of Grayscale. Jon decides to go south, leaving Sansa as regent. Qyburn unveils the Scorpion. And Grey Worm and Missandei finally hook up. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve Hot Pie is back.
Hot Pie is back, and he is not on a gluten-free diet.
No, he's not. You got to brown that butter, Steve.
He may be a gluten-specific diet.
It just warmed my heart, man. It warmed my heart to see Hot Pie back.
No, yeah. I mean, there's no objection here. Bring me some Hot Pie.
I thought that was actually quite a nice scene, and it made me think, it did so much, actually. That scene actually did quite a bit of work, besides just the nostalgia of having Hot Pie back.
Right.
And, you know, it's nice to know that he really still does care about the work, right?
Cares about the work.
Because a lot of people, they'll chase their dreams, and then when they start getting paid to do their dreams, it kind of just becomes... grind,
you would,
right?
Do what you love and you'll never work another day in your life. Hot Pie.
It ties up several storylines. It reminds the audience what happened to the phrase. Brienne gets mentioned, so there's a callback there.
Yeah.
You have some mention of Cersei, and then Arya finds out about the Boltons, right?
Yeah, so the potential redirection, right? I mean, that's...
So in like a very short space, you kind of get this Arya caught up on... all of the politics in Westeros that she's missed.
And it reminds the audience. This is a real good example of proper exposition done well, right?
Right. So given that we had all this, you know, we had the nostalgic reunion, we had the laugh, we had Arya meet someone who doesn't want to murder anyone. It just really kind of makes that Ed Sheeran stuff seem...
So gratuitous because all of that could have been done in this. In fact, it kind of was done in this.
It was done and you didn't need it and it took you out. And
the beauty of this is that
it costs less than Ed Sheeran.
Sure. And what's great about it is that you get all of the, whatever you tried to achieve in that last Ed Sheeran scene, you've got this and then some in an economy of time with a character that already existed, and it grounds Arya. And it also reminds, what's nice about this scene is it reminds you a little bit that Arya is not just a death machine.
Right.
You know, that it brings you back to Arya. So I think that's helpful for her character, because you could start to pull back from Arya, because even as she's starting to get revenge against people that have wronged her and her family, you can get turned off by the violence and the single-mindedness of revenge.
And also gives you a very sort of... It literalizes this metaphor of identity, because she has to make this choice. Do I go south and cross a name off my list? Or do I go north and have this family reunion with John?
Right, which could in some ways mean that that's where I'm going to stay.
Right. And she decides to go north.
So that's all. I mean, all of that's great. And none of it had Ed Sheeran in it.
So you almost get this sense that, like, oh, there's hope. Like, she's not just a death machine.
Right. Now, when Bruno Mars shows up, I'm questioning whether or not I'm going to get on board with that.
And then Arya has this reunion with her old wolf.
Right.
This was the only scene in the show where I really felt like they made the direwolf look like this, you know, otherworldly beast. I felt like in all of these other shows...
They look like regular sized wolves.
They just look like regular wolves. And then I saw this and I thought, that's what they should have been doing the whole time. That's what they're supposed to look like.
Right.
So I was pleased with that scene, and I did like the callback to when she tells her father, "That's not me." Okay, so like season one, he says, "You're gonna be a lady and you're gonna run a big house and you're gonna have a castle." And she tells her dad, "That's not me." And I think what she's saying there is, don't try to tame me. I don't fit the gender role that you think that I fit. And then the wolf leaves, seemingly like, no, I'm not going to be domesticated.
Right.
And she says, that's not you.
Oh, that's great.
So I love that parallel there. That was really, really well done, I thought. And no Ed Sheeran in that scene
As far as we know, we don't. I don't. He may, I think he may have
The wolf
actually
starts
been.
singing
I
with Sheeran's voice.
think Ed Sheeran was. He was the on all fours. They just CGI'd the wolf over him.
We saw the death of the sand snakes, or at least two of the three, I think.
Did we get all three? Because I know we saw two, one hanging and one sort of.
I think we saw two of the three die. And let me just say
Oh man, that makes up for a lot of Ed Sheeran.
that, oh my gosh, that scene where you're on like coming down that plank, that
Dude,
lowering
this has
plank.
got to be everything for you, man. I mean, it's got to
Oh,
be.
I've been waiting the entire show for this,
But
man.
it's got to be conflicting because also you're watching ships burn, so this has got to be
Yeah, I don't like
the
seeing
best of
that.
times and the worst of times for you. So here's where it's an interesting. Take a step back for a second, and it's like I'm like, all right, I was okay with the first episode. I know it had a little slowness, and there was Ed Sheeran, but this one was like, this episode was fantastic.
Nonstop. Great. I loved. You know what? Euron just knows how to make an entrance. This guy, he has not been on this show for very long, but when he like smashes into Yara's ship, I'm
Yeah.
thinking, oh, hell yes.
Yeah, that was pretty rad. I mean, that was cool. The battle scene, like, and just that tension of, oh man, this complicates everything. Because I mean, Tyrion had this great plan, and that's the thing. It's like, and you had Lady Olenna talking about, be a dragon, this or that, and there was this whole all this stuff is sort of building up, and then you see this plan kind of, and immediately the plan starts to fall apart. And what's fascinating is that it's like, the Lannisters don't have a lot of allies right now, but they had one good ally in the right spot at the right time.
That's exactly right. And it kind of shows you how quickly things can turn. You know, because Dany just looks like she just looks unstoppable.
Right.
She's like a juggernaut, and then it's like all of a sudden she's fighting with one arm behind her back.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a wonderful scene, and it did confirm to me that don't bring a whip to a sword fight,
No,
man.
that's all I kept saying.
Whips suck. I mean, unless you're Indiana Jones.
A whip is your secondary weapon. Sword in one hand, whip in the other. Not all whip all the time. Yeah, that was easy. And watching the elimination of the sand snakes, because the thing is that whole scene with Yara and what's her butt from Dorne is, it goes on for so long, and you're just like, and it was so boring. I'm like, God, it does. You can take the woman out of Dorne, but you can't take Dorne out of the woman. This is Dorne somehow, you put Dorne on a ship, and now that ship is boring.
I'll tell you what, man. When Theon jumped overboard,
Oh boy.
that guy sure knows how to jump, man. He's had a few like important jumping
Yeah.
scenes.
Great. I really that was probably one of the more discussed moments, I think, of that episode afterwards between Heather and I.
Oh
Just
yeah,
that.
tell me that. Give me a little
Well,
synopsis.
just the whole idea of like, 'cause I'm like, is this what did he flee? I don't get the sense that he just I didn't get the sense that he was just going to bail. And she's like, oh, I don't think he bailed. I think that this is a bigger picture. He knew that if he goes forward, it's probably certain death, whereas now he may at least have an opportunity to help, because he knows who and where and all these different things. And I was like, oh, okay. So it just became, it was an interesting take, because Theon.
So what is your take now?
I'm not exactly. I still wasn't sure.
I see. I think that you can take Reek, the name Reek, off the person, but you can't take Reek out of.
Yeah.
It.
So there was definitely an element of that, right? Like, I don't want to. But the thing is, the thing about Reek is he's a servant.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's an. So I feel like Theon jumps, Reek stays. Oddly enough.
I think that he just got. I mean, Euron is just so scary.
Yeah.
He's like the scariest guy around, and I think that kind of.
You thought it was just like it was a Ramsay.
Yeah, kind of, I think kind he just thing. He just feels like I'm out of here.
I've done this before.
I am way out of here. I don't know. There's something about that felt like truer to his nature than, you know, him actually fighting and.
No, yeah, and I think that was good. I think it was the right thing, because I was like, well, this could be a moment where, like, that felt like here's that die for your sister redemption or something. And I'm like, I'm not, and I'm glad they didn't, because then I would have felt, it would have felt a little contrived. So the jump made more sense from a character perspective.
Yeah. All right. I could watch Littlefinger get choked.
Oh, that was awesome.
I love that Jon has not said two words to this guy, but he already knows he hates his guys.
Oh man, that was great. That was so good. Yeah, definitely upped John even further. I really liked the idea that we see. So John and Danny are obviously on a collision course of some sort.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of parallels. You know, one reborn by fire, one reborn in the ice, even though it was through the Lord of Lights, whatever, but regardless, location. And they're sort of, you know, one is a reluctant leader. The other one is she believes it's, you know, destiny. Ironically, they're related. But you see, there's also this parallel trajectory of Littlefinger and Varys. Because I think the last time we saw them together, we really saw, you know, Varys has his intent, which is peace, and, you know, and that was echoed. And then Littlefinger is power. And he believes that there's no such thing as this. This is all a ruse. Even you don't believe this, you know, altruistically, you just couldn't. So they each have an interaction with the counterparts, right? The John and Danny. And Danny was just much more like, I don't have any reason why I should trust you. You would have had me killed. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, there's a lot of honesty back and forth, like a ton of honesty between them. And then she shows him mercy and gives him a threat. Because I think there is a sense of like, look, I mean, you do seem like you're valuable, but you also seem untrustworthy.
Well, he says, I'm not, clearly he's more loyal to what he perceives as the well-being of the people.
Right.
Than he is to her cult of personality.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes him unique.
Because everybody else is bought into her.
Yeah, exactly.
And then on the flip side, you have Littlefinger just peppering John with information. Uh-huh. and his so-called intentions. And John just does not want any of it. And so I love that comparison of how those two characters are being viewed. Not entirely trusted, one way less so than the other, but the one has value. And then so where Danny is like, all right, I will let you live because you have value, so to speak. And then on the flip side, Littlefinger is like, hey, you need to recognize my value. Like basically, thank you. You should be thanking me. Mm-hmm. Very much reminding me of the wolf Vincent Vega.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Please would be nice. and so I really like those, watching that dynamic, because I think the Littlefinger Varys dynamic is an underrated one. And since we haven't seen it together for a while, it's nice to see the sort of the juxtaposition. And they're both right there, right? I mean, they're both right alongside these leaders that could, you know, changed the course of the rule for a while.
There are very few scenes where I have to actually watch through my fingers, Steve. This scene of Jorah's skin condition getting cut off.
Yeah, you and Heather both, man. I it didn't bother me even a little.
Really?
Bit.
I mean, just oh man, the immediate pus that comes out, and then just his the way he plays it.
Oh, he plays it. The acting is great.
I've seen people get beheaded and tortured, and you know how they're flayed, dismembered. That scene really got me. I don't know, man. I don't know what it was. It was well shot, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, really well done. I was all concerned that a piece was going to splatter onto Sam.
Well, okay, so he's wearing gloves, right?
No face shield.
Yeah, no, they haven't. I guess he could, like, put on a helmet.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, you know, helmet up, bro.
So Jorah's seemingly going to be healed, I would imagine.
Right? And the reason he's doing this is because of just the Mormont name.
Yeah, I think J.R. Mormont holds a place in his heart. The way I read it was, I wasn't strong enough to help your dad, but I could help his son.
Yeah, I could see that.
Or maybe it's just like a pride thing, like, here's something that I think I can do.
Yeah, I think it's also like, hey, man, I've been cleaning diarrhea and making soup. I've been here for a while. I'm ready. I can't go back home and tell Gilly about another day of spooning diarrhea. I gotta say, hey, I cured someone with grayscale today, Gilly.
You know, it makes me like the montage scene last episode even better, because one thing that you can do with a montage is that you can, it's kind of shorthand for the passage of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do get a sense that Sam's been there for a while.
Yeah.
Whereas the amount of time he's been on screen since he, you know, made it to Old Town, it could just be like, you just got here yesterday, dude. Like,
right.
So the montage was pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's how I took that anyway.
All right. Qyburn says that he's got a solution for the dragons.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, you know, he's formidable just and understated. You know, he's never going to like boast about it. But he has this little sort of sadistic glee on his face. Like,
yeah.
And then we go down and we see the, you know, big scorpion.
And now we're like, is he going to regenerate a dragon? Is he?
Well, yeah, right. Yeah, I think initially that's what people were thinking. People were thinking like, well, Qyburn can bring back the mountain. Why can't he like bring back a zombie dragon or something like
right.
that?
Right.
But so this kind of, I think that the scorpion is something of a callback to Joffrey's love for crossbows.
Mm.
And that was kind of Joffrey revealing himself to be the most, as I think, the most monstrous.
Right.
You know, that little sort of exchange between him and Margaery back in the day when he was, you know, he just had this little glee on his face about murder.
Yeah.
And so I think that this is kind of Cersei going full monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was, yeah, super effective. I really liked that a little bit. I like the, because that kind of goes back to when you talked last episode about, you know, too powerful, right? Like, too is Arya too powerful? It's like, well, she was kind of neutralized a little bit, right? Because if she was no one, like she was training to be,
right,
you could make the argument she would be too powerful. But because she is Arya, that's her, that might be the kryptonite, is that she is still Arya, and going home now sort of changes the trajectory.
Yeah, and on that same note, you know, the worry would be Dany's too powerful.
Yeah, now you
but
have
at the end of this episode,
crossbow.
It's like, oh, wow, this is actually going to be more of an even fight than we thought.
Right, exactly, because you get three good shots off, and Dany now, especially with the ships gone, it doesn't look, you know, so that's the thing, right? You needed that. You needed a neutralization of some sort.
Cersei.
And you know the White Walkers are too powerful, but we know that their weakness is just a matter of
Yeah.
got to get that dragon glass.
All right, so I just got this tiny little thrill hearing Jon, Sansa, and Davos talk about Dany. And on the flip side here, Mel and Tyrion and Dany talk about Jon.
Yeah, that was good. Like these little parallels are I think are real fun.
Because you've been watching these characters for, 6 seasons now.
Yeah.
And a little mention here and there, but Dany's never heard of Jon before.
Right.
That's what her reality has been. Of course, she's had bigger fish to fry.
Yeah. And then I love the idea of like Tyrion coming back and like Sansa being like, well, yeah, you can trust Tyrion, but don't go. Like I love all that part of it, right? Because and I feel it's good because Tyrion's goodwill, it helps, and it echoes, and I think that that's good, and I think that that's right, and I
And
think that
I think
that
you called this. So when we were talking about Tom's death, your take on this was, this is going to be women in leadership all around, right? So John deciding to go south puts Sansa in charge of the north.
Right.
So now you have Cersei in charge of King's Landing. You've got Dany in charge of the rebellion or whatever. You've got, if you just think about her council, it's like Ellaria and Yara and Lady Olenna. And now you've got Sansa in charge of the north.
Right.
So you kind of saw that coming.
And yeah, and then presumably John is headed to bend the knee, or at least that's what
That's what Danny
Danny
wants.
wants. So then that kind of subjugates him even further.
Jamie is using Randall's xenophobia to persuade him. And I don't think I caught this the first time I watched this, but that whole scene with Randall Tarly and Sam, it really does play up the fact that he hates Gilly because she's a foreigner, right?
Sure. Yeah, that kind of helps.
Right? So she's not just she's like a savage in his eyes. And so Jamie kind of susses out something about him and suggests that here Dany is back and she's got this army of savages.
Right.
So very few scenes with that guy, Randall Tarly, but a very effective storytelling. Like, what do I know about this guy? He's really stern. He hates Sam, and he's just real xenophobic, right?
Yeah.
So, very. I thought that was pretty effective.
Agreed. Yeah, that was good. And yeah, I mean, again, economy of time, but a lot said.
New actor for Dickon Tarly. Do you miss the old Dickon, Steve?
We didn't really know that Dickon too well.
You're not pining for
I'm not pining for the original.
the original Dickon. Did you recognize the actor who's the new Dickon?
No.
I think he's best known for, like, he's the main guy on Umbrella Academy.
Okay.
And if you're not familiar with Umbrella Academy, he's got the head of a human and the body of a gorilla.
Oh.
Which I thought, that's not such a bad idea for this show. To have Dickon Tarly be half gorilla.
That's not so bad.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and bald move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Jason, I think you have one of my favorite podcasting voices.
Aw, that's really nice. You have a nice voice too.
I wasn't fishing for a compliment.
No, I know, but I thought that when you first came on, but I thought it would be a little weird for that to be one of the first things I said to you. I actually, when I first heard myself, I think most podcasts probably say this, but I couldn't stand the sound of my voice.
Yeah. No, I think that's a pretty common experience, but
yeah,
I think you have a very distinct voice. I feel like if listeners of this podcast like jumped in the middle, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, Jason's on. I know that voice."
Yeah, I guess so.
Do you get that a lot?
One thing that happened that was super funny one time is I was in my local comic book shop. And I had a Walking Dead comic in my hand and I was talking to the clerk about it. Uh-huh. And the guy behind me was like, "You do a podcast, right?" And so, I mean, I think especially if someone right. heard me talking about the Walking sure. Dead, the context would they'd totally pick it up for sure.
You're walking around parading around waving a Walking Dead comic. People would probably notice that it's you, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. So, Jason, we are about 3 years out from the start of season 8 of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it seems like it has not been that long ago that it ended. Uh-huh. Seems like it's been about a year ago or something.
So I think one of the things I was curious, I kind of was, it's hard to know when a retrospective is warranted on something that was important in my life. Like, is 1 year too short of time? Is 3 years yeah, too right. long? That kind of thing. And I guess I've been wondering whether, because there's just tons of content, not just tons of content, but tons of really great content on all kinds of different screens these days. And I always wondered, like, will Game of Thrones kind of fade into the wallpaper?
Yeah.
In sort of the cultural consciousness. So let me get your take on this. What is your sort of retrospective on the sea of content and the place that Game of Thrones occupies in that sea?
I mean, I think Game of Thrones is one of the greatest shows ever made. And so, I mean, there is so much content. I was looking it up. The most recent year I could find data on was 2019, where it said there was something like 519 scripted shows in existence.
Right.
And more than, you know, one day you could watch a new show every day of the year and still only be about halfway done. And even with that, I used to listen to a podcast about writers who were showrunners, and the host would get different showrunners together and just talk TV. And it was really fascinating. And every episode, no matter what showrunners they had on there, they would mention Game of Thrones in revered right. tones, like, you know, because they also create shows. A lot of times it'd be like, "Oh my God, yeah, I could never even reach the heights of that show." And but on the other hand, I think because of the way that it ended, which kind of didn't satisfy most people. And I have my own thoughts on that, which maybe don't exactly go with the general consensus, but I think it's tainted. And so I think if they had stuck the landing in a mm-hmm. way that people felt was consistent with the earlier seasons,
right.
it would be in this rarefied air, like you've mentioned in your notes to me. Is it more like 1977 Star Wars or 1989 Batman? I think it would be more like 1979 or 77 Star Wars if it had really stuck the landing. But
yeah.
since most people agree it didn't, I don't think it's quite... I think it lost a lot because of that. I think it will still be remembered for sure, but not in the way that it's not like the James Dean of shows, you know, where it's like this icon. I mean, it still is, but just not as high up.
Let me ask you this. It's a great place to start. Were you ever a fan of Breaking Bad?
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite shows, if not my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's probably in my maybe top 10 mm-hmm. shows I've ever watched. And you can disagree with me on this too, but I think that show stuck the landing, right?
I do. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you could argue that it was maybe a little too nice of an ending, but I still felt very, very satisfied with it. So, yeah.
Well, let me put it this way then. I don't feel like the end of the show seemed like an altogether different series than the one I began.
No.
I feel like they were true to the theme. They were true to a few of the key characters. We had some really satisfying resolutions. I mean, you could quibble with a couple things, but
yeah.
I feel like they saw it through and ended well.
Absolutely.
And
I know, and because of that, Breaking Bad has maintained its cachet in a way that Game of Thrones maybe hasn't.
That's where I think I was going to say something different. I think I was going to say something like, even with that, even though Breaking Bad stuck the landing, I have gone back and rewatched favorite episodes of Game of Thrones a number of times. I still feel a certain affection for some of the, you know, the massive ensemble cast. I just, there's something about Game of Thrones that is still higher on my list than Breaking Bad, even knowing that Game of Thrones didn't stick the landing in the way that I would have hoped.
I mean, I think anyone who examines and analyzes these things and is really into it would, it's such an impressive show on many, many different levels. I just think for the general public, who doesn't think so deeply about it and is more just sure. going by what their feeling is,
right.
they might not feel that way. But I agree with you. I think it's a more impressive show. I don't know if that's exactly what you're saying, but I think it is.
Well, okay, you said that you might have a kind of a diverging opinion, and I wonder, let me throw this idea at you. Do you think that most people are dissatisfied with the ending, or do you think that it's just the vocal minority that's dissatisfied with the ending? Because the numbers of the show only ever went up, right?
Yeah. It's hard to know. My experience of the show is filtered through episode by episode podcasting that I did at the end. We started with season 5.
Sure.
And went from there. And the people that I was podcasting with, you know, we had several of us, we'd rotate in different people. Uh-huh. And some of them were just pissed off and really deeply hurt by the whole thing.
Oh no. You know,
like a life-changing kind of a thing.
Right.
And a couple of others of us loved it and thought, I mean, I personally think that the pacing is the major problem. Uh-huh. If it had been paced similarly to the rest of the series,
yeah.
you could have had the same things happen, but just more fleshed out. It would have been amazing. It was amazing already, but that would have really stuck the landing. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, how do you know what the non-vocal majority thinks?
That's right. Yeah, no, I think that's... I guess I'm asking that sort of rhetorically. And I guess I'm glad to hear that experience from you, because if you really care for these people you're watching alongside, it's hard not to experience this show through their eyes, right?
Yeah. I mean, for me as a podcaster, I tend to like to take an opposing viewpoint occasionally, so it was almost like that made me like it even a little bit more.
A little contrarian in
you. A little bit sometimes.
I will say this. So Aaron and I were trying to promote this book, Gods of Thrones, about the time that season 8 came out.
Yeah.
And we are going to do one last promotional video, or not video, but podcast about the book the night after the final episode, season 8. And I remember walking in the Bald Move studio. It was just me and Aaron. And I said, he said, what'd you think? And he was clearly, it was like someone had just killed his dog. He just he was so wounded. I felt so bad. I wanted to give him a hug.
Oh, man.
He was so wounded. He's like, what did you think? And I heard the words, I loved it, come out of my mouth.
Mm.
And I realized, like, I did have trouble with it. Like, there was a lot of things I had trouble with. But in the end, I think I loved it. And I mean, it was like I was pouring salt in the wound.
Yeah.
I should have nuanced. But I will say there was a lot that I did love about it. I mean, I
Absolutely.
Think in retrospect, Absolutely. I can see a lot. I would have done a few things very differently than what they did. But there was just so much I loved about it. And I really feel something of a divided mind about this, about season 8 in particular. I don't know. It's hard not to think, if I had not been watching with a second screen, or if I had not been watching while I was also listening to podcasts, or if I had not been watching while I was also looking at social media, I wouldn't have nearly the amount of nits to pick about that show mm-hmm. that I ultimately did. And yet there's part of me that thinks, but that actually, all of those things also enhanced my enjoyment of certain parts
yeah.
of the show, right?
I mean, you think back, you know, Happy Days, or I don't know, I'm trying to think of an earlier show sure. that we all fell in love with, MASH, uh-huh. you know, I don't uh-huh. know, had nitpicking social media around it, it would have been a whole different experience of the show, and maybe not as good.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question about that. So mm-hmm. I feel like and I don't know if you remember.
But wait,
hold on
though.
Yeah, yeah.
I think even if there was no social media around Game of Thrones, a lot of people would have been shocked by what Daenerys did in a way where they did not agree with the show going in that direction, mm. even without the social media. I think they would have been hurt by that.
Mm.
That's my gut feeling about it. I'm not saying I was, but I'm just mm-hmm. saying I think a lot of people would have.
No, I think you're right about that. And for me, I kind of saw Daenerys turning at some point.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that was the question. Like, yeah. which way would that Targaryen coin flip land for Daenerys? That was the question, right? So
right.
you had to, if you're going to ask the question, you got to be ready that the answer might not be what you like.
Right. Yeah, for me, it was always, I always kind of thought, no, this, she's a Targaryen. History repeats itself. There is going, that's one of the things that these stories do. It, mm-hmm. it tells you a story from 20 years ago, and then the consequences of that story are going to play out 20 years from now. I thought, she's a Targaryen. She's trying to conquer with dragons. This is going to go badly. It's amazing that everyone has fallen in love with this character who I'm pretty sure is going to be the villain in the end. Right.
That's interesting.
And
see,
and yet,
now I listened to your most recent episode, part of it anyway.
Uh-huh.
You guys were talking about whether the casting of what's her name? Emily.
Oh, Emile Clark. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Emile Clark. And maybe she was too charming for the part, but I think it was great because the show gave us, like, you always ask, you think about tyrants in history, how could they have had such a passionate and loyal following uh-huh. when they're such a horrible person? We got the emotional experience of that. So
yeah.
I think that was brilliant. You know, I mean, people were so on her side, most people mm-hmm. and wanting her to succeed. But the seeds were always planted of what was going to happen.
Right.
She was going to kill with fire and blood and burn cities to the ground from season 1.
Well, that's right. You know, Martin can play with this sort of thing, and he kind of shows that he does this throughout. He'll create a villain like Theon, right? Just villainous villainy coming out of this guy.
Douche.
And then all of a sudden he'll give you, like, something will turn and you'll start to feel empathy for a person that you never thought you'd feel empathy for, right?
Love that.
Or Jaime Lannister. Jaime Lannister, like, first episode, this guy tried to murder a child, right? To keep a secret.
He could go sleep with his sister.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. He just looks like a bad guy. He is a bad guy. Everything I know about storytelling is that this is your bad guy, right? And within, what, 4 or 5 episodes, I'm really interested in this guy. And within 4 or 5 seasons, I've fallen in love with him. It's a really amazing trick.
I love it. Yeah.
And so it's kind of, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that we should have been so surprised that Emile Clarke could turn into the bad guy at some point. But I wonder a little bit, like, would it have been possible to have her do what she did, but in the end sort of recapture the empathy that we had in the beginning? I think that it would have required maybe another season. And they were certain, they just were not willing to do that, right?
I even to get to that point, like, even though she laid, even though I do believe all the seeds were laid for that, just the fact that she had succeeded in her mission and then chose to go around and burn the inhabitants of King's Landing, really, you really needed to, I always think the perfect ending for anything is surprising in the moment, but then feels inevitable once you think about it. That's just the great kind of ending. And to me, it was surprising, but I don't think it quite...
Let's be honest. Can you imagine how difficult that kind of thing is when you have the number of viewers that Game of Thrones had?
Yeah. Millions.
Yes.
I just think if they had taken more time to get her to that. I mean, I know they wanted it to be a surprise, so it's very tricky, but they did, you know, they had her talking about how you need to either rule by love or by fear. Mm-hmm. And then in another scene saying, the people of King's Landing don't love me. And she was frustrated by that. And so I think that's kind of what was at the core of why she did that, to rule by fear over these people who don't love her. And yet still it felt like, what? Why is she doing that? Instead of, oh, wow, she really did it. You know, and if they could have had her, the audience have more of that feeling, like, oh my God, okay, she actually did it, versus what the fuck, then right. I think it would have been better somehow. I don't know how to do that. I'm not a writer, but.
Right. No. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, Jamie is a great example of this, because it's like, okay, so what, you know, the guiding motivation for Jamie is, well, I guess you could say it's two. It's like to be the best artist with the sword who ever lived, right? But to be devoted, faithful, and in love with Cersei, right?
Right.
And in both of those ways, I don't think they ever betrayed his character. So even if he started doing things driven by those motives that made him seem heroic at times, they were still true to the motives of that character.
That's another storyline that I think a lot of people were dissatisfied with, that he went back to Cersei. And I thought it was great because, I mean, it's the kind of mistake that people make with Game of Thrones, starting with Ned Stark. You try to plug them into the typical heroic arc, and it felt like, okay, he's Jaime's overcome his flaws and has become this shining knight. But no, he's a human being who's in love with his person, and that's more important than anything to him. And he stayed true to that in the end, even though we all hate her and wish he'd stayed with Brienne, who's awesome.
So I don't know if you can kind of compartmentalize your experience of that decade of Game of Thrones, but for me, I kind of feel like there was that kind of the aha moment of Game of Thrones. Like, I didn't have the experience of reading the books before I watched the show. And so that first episode for me just felt like, it felt like a revelation. It just felt like, I can't believe I get to watch this. And then it became sort of this online sensation, which included podcasts and Reddit and all of these things for me that sort of bespoke seasons 2 to 5.
Okay.
And then, and right now on this podcast, we're sort of doing a rewatch of season 6 right now. And I felt like season 6, it kind of ascended to a new level. Like, I'd be at the Giants game, and like Hunter Pence would walk, his walk-up music was Game of Thrones. It was everywhere.
Yeah. It was at a time culturally where if you weren't watching it, most likely it was an obstinate choice. Like,
yeah,
I'm not
gonna... weren't watching it, you were sort of left out of a number of conversations.
Yeah.
Right. And it kind of became, at that point, it became something that a very, very few shows have ever ascended to. Right. It's sort of at the peak of its power,
the
I
show.
Would say. Yeah. It was the show. Right. And it would be something like, you know, in the same way that men of my age will often refer to lines from The Godfather or Star Wars or something like that, it became one of these things where people would start comparing themselves or claiming characters. She's my character, that kind of thing. wearing T-shirts, I drink and know thing. It just became this massive cultural phenomenon.
I mean, right now I'm drinking House Baratheon Royal Lochnagar.
That's awesome. All right, so then inexplicably the show just took a different tone. And so I think some of the pacing issue that you mentioned before, the season 7 and 8, I think that it started to feel different. It started to feel like a rush to the end. In fact, even the episodes started to be different. Like, the seasons were a different length, and the episodes were a little bit longer. And
it felt even in some ways going back to season 5. Although sometimes I wonder if I noticed that more just because that's when I started doing episodic podcasting. But less sophisticated and a little more a little ham-fisted sometimes in the storytelling, like
sometimes.
A lot of emotional setups that were there clearly just for some payoff. And so I found,
yeah. What do you have in mind? Like, what would be an example of one of those, of something that,
like in season 5, you have Shireen and Stannis Baratheon at Castle Black, and he's mostly treated her like dirt throughout the rest of the show. But they have this really touching scene where she asks if he's ashamed of her. And he tells her the story of how everyone told him to send her off to the stone, live out the rest of her days with the stone men. But no, he hired experts to come and try to cure her and arrest the spread of grayscale, because you're the princess and you're my daughter. And it was such a moving moment. And they hugged and I was full of tears. And then when he then chose to have her burned at the stake a few episodes later, I felt like, wait, I think that moment was just in service of this moment versus, and maybe I'm being picky, but it just felt kind of emotionally manipulative to me. And things like that happen in TV all the time, but maybe I'm missing it. I need to go back and do a rewatch myself, but it felt like Game of Thrones was more sophisticated than that early on. I don't know.
That's funny. I was just rewatching Hard Home the other day, and there's this moment where this wildling woman who we just met that episode is like trying to get people out to the ships and away from the oncoming zombie apocalypse or whatever. And she says goodbye to her children and she says, "I'll be right back." And immediately I thought, of course,
you're dead.
You're dead. This is the way it goes in television shows. If there's someone that you care about and you need to sort of create a sense of empathy for that person, you're going to send their children away and have the person say, "I'll be right back." And I kind of felt like, of course, that's exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. But for some reason, that worked for me in that episode.
And maybe the whole series is full of that, but I don't think so. I think it started happening more as they started getting past the books and needed to sort of rely on their own devices.
Interesting.
I think.
So yeah, no, that's a good. So for you, the show must have taken on a huge shift at season five, because that's when you started covering it, right?
It did. And I mean, we did occasional episodes talking about a full season, you know, mm-hmm. so we were already into it, but then we're like, hey, let's just do a full one podcast where we cover every episode. And then I felt like, wow, season five seems especially hard to talk about. Hmm. And I think I put my foot in my mouth a couple times because of the sensitive subject matter, you know. It was rough.
Of course. No, it absolutely, that season was rough. Yeah. And I do feel like there was a certain, so you jumped into the podcasting right then. I was able to just let it wash over me and experience mm-hmm. it. But then you also jumped into the controversy, because that was,
yeah.
the show got controversial in a way that it hadn't been around season five.
Yeah, I would say definitely.
Which probably doesn't hurt for a podcaster, but then you got to be super careful about it.
Yeah, I mean, the way in particular that we talked about, you know, Sansa's quote unquote wedding night mm-hmm. with Ramsay was clumsy, to put it kindly. And so then in the next episode, I made sure that we asked two women to host that one, and I came on and apologized for my clumsiness and mm-hmm. had them take over, you know. And
credit to you for recognizing it and then getting out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, thank you.
Because a lot of people would double down on that, right?
Exactly, yeah. And yeah, and I didn't want to do that. I want to be sensitive, and I'm grateful for the feedback from our listeners and everything, and I've totally grown from being a podcaster, you know. I think being a podcaster will show you your flaws as a person, mm-hmm. especially if you have a lot of engagement with your audience, which I love to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it was fascinating to talk about that, but it was hard to, not just that moment either, just season five was hard in particular. But on the other hand, I think one of the best things about Game of Thrones is how nasty a show it can be.
Well, it's true, and you know, the showrunners made a few mistakes specifically around rape that I would never liked. But I will say this, that the show was able to bring us to moments, glimmers of hope in a way, because the default position was so dark to begin with, right? So for instance, we really did rejoice with the heroism of Arya.
Yeah.
That was done at the expense of horrible things happening to Arya throughout, right? Mm-hmm. We watched her go from, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire over and over and over again, and tragically become a, you know, a super assassin. You know, we this is not something to celebrate in a little girl at all, but right. It's for our entertainment. And we kind of reveled in both the laments and the victories in her story. And she became, you know, a lot of people's favorite character, mm-hmm. My favorite character for sure. Mm-hmm. And the only way that story works is if the darkness around her is believable. And that's something that set this show apart.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what elevates this show above the kind of show where you expect the hero to only grow in a positive direction and be mm-hmm. a shining knight at the end, because this show is more about human truth in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. I think. And that's what I love about a good story, is when it gets at human truth, and there's vanity and there's greed and there's stupidity and all kinds of things about humans that cause conflict that happen mm-hmm. in this show that feel like they're based in some root of truth about the way people can be.
Right. And, mm-hmm. you know, loosely a recasting of a few moments in human history, mm-hmm. you know, even if the outcomes are fantastic. The premises are borrowed, you know. The premise, George was constantly borrowing premises.
And that was kind of the point, right? Like him being like, I'm a student of history, and this is how it usually goes.
Hey, I want to ask you, like, I don't know if you've thought about what made the show special in your mind. I mean, I guess you could, you don't have to be super reflective. You could say, yeah, it was the right show at the right time. And, you know, it broke some ground in a number of ways. Or I don't know if there's anything specific about it when you think back to it and be like, this is what made that show special.
Well, a lot of the things that we've been talking about, you know, just how cruel the show could be, but having really the Starks at its heart, who are these good people that we were rooting for the whole time and trying to navigate their way through it. You know, Sansa and Arya and Jon and Ned at first, Rob, and some of them failing. But I mean, if they had all died, then it probably wouldn't have been too much, you know. Mm-hmm. So some of them made it through. And so just having that good heart, that good core, but having the kind of things like so awful what happened to Shireen being burned, mm-hmm. Gregor Clegane gouging Oberyn's eyes out. I mean, starting with Bran, what happened to him and Jaime in the first episode, and then Ned. I mean, what happened to Ned really just was like, okay, this is not like other shows. Yeah. It's not what I thought. And then Arya feeding Walder Frey to his own family in a pie. I mean, that was a joyous moment, but it's dark as hell.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dany at King's Landing. I mean, it's so dark and cruel and the nasty is the word that I call it, just a nasty kind of a show, mm-hmm. that somehow was so freaking captivating. That was part of it. That's not the only thing. I mean, yeah. Also there's the spectacle of it that just got more and more amazing over the years with Miguel Sapochnik directing, right. These amazing episodes, just some of the best TV ever shown, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And I think almost if you were going to rewind even like 15 years before the show started, so instead of 2010, let's say it was 95 or something.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely wouldn't have the special effects, I don't think.
Right. Mm-mm. And then, you didn't even have it in the early seasons.
Sure. Right. And then if you were to fast forward even 10 years or so, I feel like the internet took a turn just in the last 10 years that makes it really hard to have a show with that, you know, sort of a universally loved show. I don't know. Do you think that much has changed, or maybe I've just changed?
No, I've often felt like maybe Game of Thrones is the last like unifying show, you know, and even Game of Thrones. I mean, if you look at the numbers, MASH, what had like 50 million people or something watching the finale, and Game of Thrones was around 17 million or something.
And that was even a low number, because just think of the amount of people that were, you know, watching the show illegally or borrowing a friend's.
Right. Yeah. It's just I don't know. Part of it is just as simple as there are so many more shows now that, and it's the culture, the internet. Yeah. Yeah. I think what you're getting at is, the internet has kind of fractured the culture. We've all found our bubbles, and so it's harder for us to all come together on any single thing, right?
Yeah, I don't want to make too hard of a case on this, but I do think that there was something about the moment in time for Game of Thrones that made it a perfect show for that particular time.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know exactly the elements that went into it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was a kick-ass show that came along when we were all still watching HBO, you know, like when we could all still, I mean, it's not that simple, but there is something to it, just that there's twice as many shows now that there were when Game of Thrones premiered in 2011, and it's only growing, so it's harder. And I swear, almost every single day, I hear about a new show that I'd never heard about before, and often they're in like their third season or something. Yeah, what? Right. Kevin Costner? I mean, Yellowstone's getting big now, but I remember when I first heard about that, it was on season 3. I was like, what? And it's crazy. Like, you can't like TV critics, they can't even, there's not enough time for them to cover all the shows anymore. So that's part of it.
Yeah, I was thinking about a couple things that sort of make it stand out for me. And I think part of it, let me just give you an example here. So Aaron and Jim were doing this really sort of heavy coverage of The Expanse, which was a great show.
I haven't seen it. I should watch it.
Yeah, see, there you go. It. Yeah. It's a really great show. And yet, I think that they would often say something like, it's sort of like Game of Thrones in space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of knew what they meant when they said that. And yet I thought, you know what makes, for me, what makes it different is like Tywin Lannister. It's like Tywin Lannister, for my money, might be the most compelling villain I've ever seen on any screen. And I, you know, up with, you know, Hal, up with Darth Vader, up with, you know, you could just, you know, you could name a few, Hannibal Lecter, whatever. Tywin Lannister was just such a compelling villain and so intricately connected with Tyrion, who's one of the most complex characters I've ever seen on a screen, and, you know, connected with Cersei and connected with Jaime and all of that business. And if you think about it, if you were going to name like the top 10, like the main characters, Tywin may not even be on the top 10 list. You know, you'd have to go through like the Stark children, and you'd talk about Sean Bean, and you talk about Emile Clarke, you talk about, you know, Tyrion Lannister. And by the time you got to Tywin Lannister, you're like, oh yeah, also Charles Dance was in this. And they did so many things with like that, where it's like, this character is absolutely a B plot character, and he is just as amazing as any. I was just re-listening to the sort of the Jason Momoa speech.
Yeah.
Like Jason Momoa didn't even make it through the end of season one. Jason Momoa was amazing in this. So I guess that I'm making a kind of a simple point. It's just that the secondary actors in Game of Thrones were among the best I've ever seen on television.
Oh, yeah. Pedro Pascal is one that stands out for me.
Yeah. So
yes, absolutely. Yes. Yes. So many great characters with great actors behind them, for sure.
So if it was just about like the shocking moments,
incredible,
you know, if it was just about Ned's beheading or the Red Wedding or whatever, you know, that those are things that actually will bring eyeballs.
Yeah.
But in order to bring the plot to life, you absolutely need a character like Tywin Lannister or a character like Lady Olenna, you know, a character like that, where you just feel like every time that they're on the screen, you can't take your eyes off that person.
Yeah, absolutely. And the writing is incredible. And, you know, it goes back to what I'm saying about human truths, that a part of the reason why these characters are so captivating is because they feel real and they feel complicated. Like, you can root for them at times, and other times they're despicable. You know, I mean, even Joffrey, you might feel sorry for him. At times, I mean, not much, but you know, you can at least recognize some of your pettiest impulses taken to the extreme in what he does. Like, it just,
well, yeah. We were talking about heroes and villains, right? So think about Tyrion's character arc. Tyrion Lannister kills Shay. He murders Shay. He strangles his lover. And two episodes later, we're like rooting for Tyrion again. I almost feel, I'll be honest, I was saying it just now, I feel a little bit guilty about it. I do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And most of the characters did something like that. Not quite that bad, but
sure.
I think everyone did something that you wouldn't approve of necessarily, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. So, all right. So I was just wondering if you'd be interested in doing a little anticipating House of the Dragon talk with me.
Sure. Yeah.
Are you planning on covering the show?
We will be covering it as a network. I think that I will be guesting on an episode here and there, but I don't know if I'm going to be covering it regularly.
Okay. All right. Do you think that that will enhance your experience, or do you feel like certainly there's less pressure in the viewing experience?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Actually, I kind of just have been going on impulse while planning how we're going to tackle that and haven't really thought too much of why. But now that you're asking me, I think it was, like self-important or something. I don't know. But to podcast on Game of Thrones is quite an endeavor, and it takes a lot of work to do it justice. Mm. And it's an emotional experience. And I just feel like I want to be able to more sit back and appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well,
certainly. So I would hope that for everyone listening too. So I've come up with a couple bits of advice, a travel guide, if you will, the three key steps on how to appreciate House of the Dragon.
Excellent.
And I want to run this past you, and I want to hear your reaction. And push back if you need to, or add things that occur to you as I'm giving you my tourist book.
Good.
All right. So think of me as a docent for the next 5 minutes.
Excellent.
Okay. Here is my advice. If you are listening and you would like to enjoy House of the Dragon, my first bit of advice is that you should not expect the show to be the best show you've ever seen. I think that's reasonable, right?
I mean, for me, that is a key mindset to go into anything, because I've learned that my expectations can completely color how I'm going to find something. If I've heard, like with Eternals, for example, it got a lot of middling reviews, mm-hmm. and I liked it. But if it had been hyped up, I probably wouldn't have liked it.
Right.
So yeah, it's almost like a little bit like, oh, wow, really? That's how much it influences you. But yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. If you just kind of don't have your expectations up too high.
If your expectation for anything is, unless this is the best thing I've ever experienced, I'm going to be disappointed.
It's a failure.
It has no chance of succeeding, right?
Yeah. But having said all that, with Miguel Sapochnik at the helm, uh-huh. I can't help but be excited for the spectacle that we're going to have. I just can't help it.
Of course. And I mean, and look, Game of Thrones is my favorite show. It's one of the best shows that's ever been on television by any standard. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that I should walk into House of the Dragon expecting that it should elevate to those heights. For instance, I could kind of almost prophesy this, that someone will come away, or let's say 5 million people will come away and say, I liked it. You know, it's not as good as Game of Thrones season 4, you know,
right.
Which to me, I feel like this is a non-statement. What, you know, it's like coming out of a concert and saying, you know what? It's fine. He's no Mozart. It's like, come on. We have to have a different standard for this sort of thing. So, yeah. So that's my advice. I'm not saying mm-hmm. having low expectations, Jason. I'm saying don't expect it to be the best thing you've ever seen. All right. So that's advice number one.
Good.
So we're on the same page. We like that.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't suggest anything else other than what you said, for sure.
Okay.
You're setting yourself up for disappointment.
Exactly.
Otherwise, yeah.
Okay. All right. This is going to be a harder one. All right. So here.
And then if it is the greatest thing ever, we'll be.
Then
really
you're
happy.
Happily surprised, right? Yeah. All right. Here's my second bit of advice. And maybe this is more controversial. I would recommend.
Take cocaine before you watch it.
Yes. At least a gummy. Just one. Right, gummy.
Right. For maybe not a bad idea.
My second bit of advice is that if you want to enjoy it, you probably should stay off social media. Mm-hmm. So for instance, like for me, if I sit down and enjoy an episode, I want to put away my phone. I just want to watch the episode. And maybe don't check Reddit that night. You know, maybe don't. Mm-hmm. Maybe
let
don't.
Let it settle.
Yes, let it settle. Mm-hmm. Enjoy it. Let it, you know, it's like tasting the soup too early, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, let the soup do what the soup needs to do. If you immediately jump online, I guarantee you you're going to find 100 people that found things to hate about the episode.
Yeah, this you're reminding me of an experience I had recently, because another show that we cover is Lock and Key on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
And we, since Netflix puts out all its episodes at once for a season,
right,
but we're covering it weekly. We don't look at any social media or news or anything because we don't want to be spoiled. Mm. And so we had our own experience of that show and we liked it a lot. And then I went back and read a lot of complaints that I had missed during the watching, you know, mm-hmm. and it started to make, oh yeah, they're right about some of that stuff. But I got to have the experience of appreciating the show before it was tainted with all of that, you know, on my own terms. It was just for me during that time. And I think I liked it more, even though I did eventually read the complaints because of that experience. I liked it more than I would have otherwise.
Right. Mm. All right. My third bit of advice, and then we will wrap up here. Mm. My third bit of advice is, and this is the same advice that I would give to someone that's like visiting Paris for the first time or visiting some historic city for the first time, is that don't experience the guidebook. Like there are going to be people anticipating the next week and they're going to tell you what you're going to experience just by guessing or because they mm-hmm. read the book or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not how you experience Paris. You don't go to Paris thinking, all right, now this is how the guidebook told me to feel about the Mona Lisa. No. The guidebook might help you get to the museum, but once you're at the museum, put the guidebook away. Try to use the guidebook as little as possible. Don't try to anticipate your experience by measuring what other people are saying. That is my... And that could be like, stay away from the source material or stay away from spoilers or whatever, which, you know, a lot of people try to do anyway. But I guess what I'm saying is more than that. What I'm saying is just because someone else feels a particular way or other people anticipate that you might feel a particular way, it shouldn't determine your experience. That's my third bit of advice.
So the guidebook ends on the advice of ignoring guidebooks.
Yes.
During the watching of the show. Yeah, I can see that. I mean... As a podcaster, it's funny. I've actually, with Jim and Aaron, you know, we both podcast on The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And they come, like Jim's come to me and be like, how can you stand up for this? It's crap at certain points, right? Yeah. Like you're not doing your job, Jason. And I'm like, I think we come at it a little differently sometimes. Like our sort of, you know, mission is to enhance the experience of this thing that we're all fans of. Whereas I think more Jim and Aaron sometimes are critics, you know, and that's cool. Like people love that.
Yeah.
But it's different. And so, I imagine with House of the Dragon, we will be pointing out some things that maybe we don't like so much, but for the most part, we'll just be celebrating it, you know, and trying to enhance it. And so I think that can be really fun for
Absolutely.
People, but at the same time, it can shape their opinion in a way that it may mm-hmm. not have been shaped before. And that's also, I think, what you're getting at too, to have the experience for yourself, right?
Absolutely. That's right. And I think I do really appreciate podcasts that will not just be cheerleaders for the show. Right.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you need to say, yeah, that didn't work for me or whatever. But, like, for instance, I do this other podcast with a comic friend of mine who actually lives in your area. You could go see him at the Punchline in San Francisco if ever you were interested. His name is Steve Osborne, and we do this show, Cocoons of Horror. And oftentimes we will cover a really bad movie. Like, we'll look at Pet Sematary. And it's just a different kind of experience. And for me, it's no less fun. I'm not angry necessarily. Yeah. I'm not angry. It's a different way to approach it. And I kind of feel like it requires just a little bit more detachment. I don't know. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like you might enjoy House of the Dragon more if you're a little bit less attached?
Yeah, I am less attached, by the way. I haven't read the books, Game of Thrones, The Song of Ice and Fire, or Fire and Blood. And I'm a huge fan of the show, but I'm not a super fan. Like, I wouldn't put it at the top of my list like it is of yours. It's in the top five.
Okay,
though.
Good.
So
no, that's great to hear that. So, I mean, but top five is pretty high.
It is high. It is high. Maybe top 10, but yeah, top 10 for sure, but uh-huh. Maybe top five, yeah. It is high still, but I don't know. I guess House of the Dragon, I don't feel as strongly about. I'm definitely intrigued. I'm pulling for it to do really well. Matt Smith is a favorite of mine, as are a few of the other actors. I think they picked the right showrunners, hopefully. But I don't know. I feel like I had the Game of Thrones experience, so I'm not clamoring for more. Mm-hmm. I'm interested, but I'm not like I said, I'm not going to be podcasting on it episode by episode. Sure. So I think it'll be easy to appreciate if it's good. I'm not like, really, really super wrapped up in it.
You know, I feel the same way about, the Rings of Power thing that's going to be coming out.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like for me, Lord of the Rings is sort of top five books. Series in my experience. I'm absolutely less invested in Rings of Power. I know what I'm getting into. This was not written by the greatest fantasy author in the history of fantasy authors. This is an Amazon Prime show.
Mm-hmm. And I'm based on some back matter.
I'm absolutely going to enjoy it. I'm not, but my expectations are a little bit lower and I'm a little bit more detached to the material.
Right.
And I think it will absolutely enhance my experience.
I get the feeling that those 3 points that you gave are things that you've been telling yourself about House of the Dragon.
It's exactly right. And I will continue to tell myself that over and over and over. And when I get too invested and I cry myself to sleep, I will tell myself the same things over.
You'll post on Reddit and then go to sleep.